failure should matter. The more failure matters, more we are engrossed in the moment. Actions, you don't need courage to take actions, it's the actions that bring courage. It's irrespective of whichever field, whether you're building, I don't know, painkiller or white pain. I think everyone should study human motivations, because all the stakeholders are humans. You said something about gamification. I think that itself is a huge thing, but I think it's one of the most poorly understood words. The joke in our company is it's like writing CPU sexual on Bumble. Everyone writes it, no one gets it. Other thing is maybe it has to do with upbringing.
Yeah.
We come from a lot of lower middle class income household. You have to hack monetization. So I have always been hacking monetization all my life. But the nuance there is, I think people got overexcited. Just like through NFT tech, you can't create Mona Lisa. NFT can enable it.
Mm.
But the underlying concept is still the underlying concept.
Hi everyone, welcome to Matrix Moments. I'm really excited for the episode today for two reasons. One is I'm talking to Dilsher, the founder of Zupi, somebody that I really, really enjoy spending time with and always learn something new when I speak to him. The second is we're doing this from a new office in Delhi, which is where Zupi is also based. So thank you, Dilsher. Thank you for taking your time and doing this with us.
My pleasure, DD. I think has been, what, 3-4 years being together?
About 4 years, yes.
Yeah. Always been an amazing partner and mentor to me, and very grateful to you and Matrix.
No, it's been our pleasure and our honor actually to be part of the journey. So Dilsher, I'm going to start with something that I think for somebody on the outside, you know, Zupi is another real money gaming startup, right? But I know what attracted me to first sort of invest in Zupi and partner with you on this journey was I always felt that you thought about the game and the company and the mission much more deeply. You always looked at Zupi as being in the business of providing joy, in the business of giving happiness, and not just as another real money gaming company, right? So let's unpack, given that also Zupi is, I guess, you haven't really been out there, marketed either yourself or the company, despite all the success, for just kind of, you know, my understanding and for whoever watches this. Tell me about what was the motivation to start Zupi and how has that evolved over time?
Sure. I think it's going to be a bit of a monologue and a long answer. And you know me, I can only give meta answers. So, give it to me. So I think it starts early. So always has been very introspective kid. Always would like to go deeper into concepts and start reading philosophy earlier. That almost caused an existential crisis as well. You know, those big, hairy questions, you know, what's meaning of life? All those things have always fascinated me. So, and the structure or the framework I got when I went to IIT Kanpur, I joined as a civil engineer, graduated as a chemical engineer, but my true passion I found there was psychology. So, there's a humanities course you have to take in first semester and it took introduction to psychology and it's like, I found my thing. So that's how it started. So, but I realized like studying human behavior is very, very convoluted. A lot of different fields of science one has to study to arrive at a deeper understanding of human mind and behavior. And this is something I'm deeply fascinated with. So I started studying evolutionary biology, how we evolved from a single cell to multicellular organism because a lot of our genetic software is hardwired. Then you study anthropology, how cultures have wired us. Then you study genetics, parent-child relationships, hormones, neurotransmitters, neuroscience, all those things. And even linguistics, you know, even the language we use shapes our behavior. So all of this starts with a deep fascination for studying human behavior. And you know the classification we talk about, painkillers and vitamins. So being deeply fascinated by building vitamins because they are around understanding fundamental human motivations. So this is like the background and then comes back to why do Zupi, why start Zupi, what were we trying to build or what were we trying to solve? So I think I always fascinated with this question, you know, what's the most important problem to solve? And while there are a lot of startups and businesses which I've been always working on, you know, longevity, extending human life, but I have always been fascinated, what about quality of life, right? Even if you look at the metrics through which countries measure their growth and success,
These are happiness index. Yeah.
These are GDP, right? Domestic production. But what about, I don't know, happiness quotient and other things. So that is how it started. Started thinking about, you know, what do humans really want? So the thesis evolved. It starts as ki maybe everyone just wants pleasure. Then, but pleasure is always like a short set. But what about something transformative? That's when I came across the concept of flow state.
Mm.
So flow state is basically you're so deep engrossed in the moment and you lose basically yourself. And that has been positively correlated with all forms of wellness across cultures, ethnicities, gender. So that's when I came across gaming and flow state. I was like, because no one designs flow state better than game designers, right? So just double clicking on what flow state is, it's basically the environment and the skills are in a certain relationship.
Mm.
If things are too difficult, we get anxious. If things are too easy, we get bored. It's about tracking the right balance
between the two.
Between the two. And then there has to be real-time feedback. And third is failure should matter. The more failure matters, more we are engrossed in the moment. The best example of that is rock climbing. So in ancient Greek times, it was seen as punishment, you know, climb a mountain and then come down and you can slip and die. Why do people do that? Because, again, timing patterns, which pattern to find then, and error matters, failure matters.
Yeah.
So looking at all of this, then I thought gaming makes a lot of sense, right, to tackle that problem. But again, in gaming, now the idea was how to do gaming. So the, and this is very clear, I'm not a philosopher. I'm a business person at the end of the day.
Really?
So, yeah. So then it's like, okay, and I think we touch on monetization, something I'm deeply fascinated with. I see monetization as one step, difficult problem to solve than engagement, specifically in a time-rich country like us. So it's like, how can I marry this? And that's when I came across the concept of pay-to-play gaming. That's when it suddenly clicked. So the monetization model, the previous, which is in-app purchase and advertisement, hasn't been working. It is improving, but still, in terms of comparing to RMG, it's not.
Especially in India, yeah.
Yeah, especially in India, it's not there. We can maybe dig deeper why is that later. So, but at the same time, this concept of failure matters.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I resonated in my childhood days as well, you know, when we used to play gully cricket. And I used to be a super competitive kid, you know, the guy who's telling all his teammates, yeah, seriously, hello, tu pehli ball pe kyun bat ghuma raha hai? Dive mar, all those things. That's what I realized when they were like small, small skin in the game, like in tournaments. The engagement, excitement was all together at a different level. So that's how all of it kind of came together. And we ended up launching an RMG platform.
Oh, I love the point on skin in the game, because I know one thing, I've been I'm still a, maybe not a daily active user, but I'm a weekly active user of Supi. The thrill of, you know, winning, even though the amount may be small.
Yeah.
That skin in the game really 10x's excitement.
Absolutely.
So I know what you mean. So I'm going to double click on one thing you said. You spoke about human motivation. And if you remember last month when we were here, we had Sanjeev come over and he made this line, which is a very simple line, statement to make, but it's so insightful. And he said, the best businesses in the world are built around a simple consumer insight.
Yeah.
Right. And you've spoken a lot about human motivation. Right. Tell me a little bit about, given, you know, we all talk about gamification as applied to every business, but you are running a gaming business itself, right? How have you studied human motivation, human desires, human sort of moods, different chemicals and how they influence behavior? How is that? Give us maybe one or two examples of how you actually used your study and depth of research in this to build a better gaming company.
Yeah. I think it's irrespective of whichever field, whether you're building, I don't know, painkiller or vitamin, I think everyone should study human motivations. Because all the stakeholders are humans. Your customers are humans. Your investors are humans. Your teammates are humans. Your policy people, regulators are humans. So studying that, and we don't actually have that culture in India. Humanity is still not very mainstream. So I think anyone and everyone should study that first of all. Now, talking a bit about that. So I think it flows into anything and everything we do. Like, let's talk about the game choices that we make. I'll maybe touch upon that at a high level. So when we were starting, there were like three games that were really working in RMG space. There was Daily Fantasy Sports, Rummy and Poker. By working, I mean like having a $100 million kind of skill, right? And that also whenever something works, it also causes like bubbles, right? So what we saw, a lot of these people are going on Play Store, taking the most popular game and integrating payment gateways and thinking, voila, we will also get that. So we saw why these three games worked and why other like whatever 250 had failed. What was the common theme on game in these games and what not in other? So decoding that absolutely to the first principles, like why this work, why doesn't work, and what are the meta game mechanics in each of the formats that work. So that's where we came up with the thesis. Like we see in RMG, there are three major segments. There's fantasy sports, there's card games, and casual games as a category was not there at all in the RMG sector.
So what are those, you said when you broke it down, you said there are underlying sort of things that make these games successful.
Yes.
Just tell us a little bit about like, what did you find?
So it's, in a way, comes down to, see, any engagement or monetization is byproduct of user personality in game meta tags.
Yeah.
They meet and some magic happens. So it's about really understanding at that level, you know, why certain games work, what kind of personality traits people have. Why do some people play PUBG kind of a game? So why do some people play Candy Crush kind of a game? Why do people some play Quiz kind of a game, right? And all can actually be broken down into personality traits. So that is the approach we took. Like casual gamers are still, even at that time, it will be 300 million casual gamers in India. We are very curious, why has no one been able to crack a casual RMG model? Again, by crack, I mean scale of 100 to $200 million.
And profit.
Yes. So that really fascinated us. So the idea is always not building a plane, but to understand why things fly, because then you can build a spaceship or whatever you want to do. So it's just looking at those fundamental game mechanics. Like, let's take an example. Let's take any game like chess. So break it down all the those pieces components that are there. So what is there? This board, there are different kind of pieces. There is a start point, end point, how rules, what is the sequence you move in, how the points are scored, how that piece can. So break it down everything and now re-engineering it in a way that the final format is actually better than the older format. And that's what we have done in our premium game Ludo. And it's not just RMG. Even our free-to-play, I think you guys would have seen the statistics report. After PUBG, Free Fire, we were the third highest time spent game. So not just RMG, the free-to-play version had much higher engagement and retention compared to original formats as well. So it actually comes down to those pieces, break it down everything, and then rebuild it again, seeing what works.
So let me ask you one question over there, actually two questions. When we invested, when you and I first met, I remember Zuppi was a quizzing game, right? And very successful one on that. Very engaging. People loved it. There was a lot of top line scale. You were still figuring out how to kind of monetize it and sort of build around it. But very quickly, you took what I thought at that time was a very hard call to say, you know what, I'm going to build something very different. And then you moved to Ludo. And obviously today now you're a platform with multiple games, several of them doing well. How did you think through that pivot? It was a hard call at that time. And second is, Ludo as a game, multiple people, like you said, right? It's not about building the plane. It's about understanding why things fly. Multiple people have tried to replicate Ludo's success or, you know, the Zuppi's Ludo game. They've tried to replicate that. Nobody's really been able to scale it as much as you have. Without revealing your secret sauce, what can you tell me about, you know, on both these?
Yeah, you rightly said we started as a quizzing platform. And, you know, there was a massive scale in terms of spend. It was like some crazy numbers. But what we figured out was that the unit economics or the margin, there were some issues in that. That just wasn't happening. And that again goes back to the fundamental game mechanics. That what we realized was, hey, this game can get massive scale. But in terms of long-term retention, high LTVs, it's going to high margins, it's going to struggle a bit. So again, without going into details, we realized that again, in the journey of understanding why things fly, there were some missing pieces. And those might have been very difficult to fix. But at the same time, we identified this gigantic opportunity, untapped.
And nobody was doing it at that
time. Nobody was doing that. And one of the...
So in some sense, you were... Do you think first to market played a role? Or is it something else?
I think definitely. And the other thing is, like I said, like you touched upon, again, understanding why Ludo RMG wasn't working. Like one simple insight is the biggest problem is uncertainty about the endpoint. Now you might want to start a game and it might go on for 2 hours. No one wants that, specifically when you've invested money, right?
Yes.
You just want quick, I want certainty. The example I give is, there used to be power cuts when I was a kid and I had to watch Pokemon at 5 p.m. So they were announced power cuts. And I used to be okay. 5 p.m. the light is going to come. And there's unannounced power, like, turning the light on and off. So, it's a lot of anxiety when there is uncertainty. So, this is like one simple insight that we took. And we've changed a lot of mechanics along with that. So, I think it goes back to neuroscience. Like, there have been so many studies about this, that when there is 100% clarity, you're going to get a reward. Or there is a 75% probability of you getting a reward versus 50% of probability of you getting a reward. That highest dopamine it is when there is 50%. Right. So again, understanding the mechanics, how we are wired, what causes what. So it's the law is very, very clear and the game has to be dominantly skill, but not pure skill.
Yes.
So how do you balance that while also delivering a great experience, but also ensuring your game is dominantly skilled? So that's where designing a state of the art quantitative framework for defining what is game of skill and what is game of chance was super helpful, because then you know which side you are playing on. And we have built that framework. The industry has accepted that framework. And we have worked with all the top professors and got vetted that. And it was first of its kind. So again, it goes back to understanding the first principles. What is that? If you understand that, then you can tweak, make changes rather than blindly doing anything.
Yeah. And coming back to the previous question, I don't know if we completely sort of did justice to it. Ludo worked really well. It continues to scale and, you know, grow very profitably. How did you think about eventually making the platform shift? A lot of your peers had made the platform shift much earlier. But for whatever reason, haven't been able to, I guess, see as much success as you, right? How did you sequence this in your head? And with the benefit of hindsight, I guess, what have you learned through that journey?
I think the analogy to give would be that you want to build a Spotify, just an analogy, that you need to have hip-hop music, as you need to have rock music, you need to have Sufi music, rap, blah, blah, blah. But the idea is really understanding what are the users coming for. And if you're just offering the same dish packaged at 6-7, then you're just cannibalizing the revenue that you're getting from the one game format. So two big things, really understanding which game, every game is like a beacon that attracts certain kind of users. So being very, very careful that whatever you're designing is actually additive in nature and it's not cannibalizing in nature. So having that understanding, otherwise most of the times what happens is you're just offering the same thing. So you're not actually creating net incremental revenue.
Yes.
And that's not platform effect. Then you're just cannibalizing. So that's where we took that.
And there is a treadmill because basically you just need to keep giving them new.
Yes. So it's not net additive because then your conversion is same. Like same user persona is only going to play certain kind of games. So yeah. TVs are stagnant. So, and the other approach we had taken very early was like, we want spray and pray. We want carpet bomb. We will really go deep into, and that's okay if we never have more than 10, 15 games, that's okay. But we will only do games which we believe has a blockbuster potential. So, and has to be net additive in nature. So, and then when a user comes, how do you hyper-personalize that experience? Right? So let's say we have cricket games as well. We have board games as well. Now you come on the platform and you are like, yeah, I don't care about board games. I just want, I don't know, to play carrom only. So now how do you hyper-personalize that and not create a choice paralysis for you? That being very clear, the moment the entire platform, how do you solve that cold start? That what is the right name for TD?
Me versus versus somebody else.
And just hyper-personalizing their journey. So there are lots and lots of nuances that go into that. But I think the key insight would be, are you designing something that is a net additive or just cannibalizing the existing thing?
Yeah. As you look out, say the next 5 years, India's at a very unique point in where it stands with gaming. There's a lot of positive sort of stuff happening on the regulatory front, and we'll talk about that. But before that, I want to know, what's your outlook on the future of gaming? What's your thesis on how does this market look 5 years from today? What are the non-obvious games that you think can become
or not even individual games, but just like what sort of thesis do you think can have potential to reach sort of substantial scale, which are beyond the non-obvious ones, right? Like fantasy is scaled, rummy is scaled, poker scaled. I guess Ludo, you had a big role in scaling and making it sort of mass now. What's your outlook on the future of gaming?
I think it's a very good question, and we'll try to do justice to this question. You said something about gamification. I think that itself is a huge thing, but I think it's one of the most poorly understood words. The joke in our company is it's like writing CPU sexual on Bumble. Everyone writes it, no one gets it. So we'll talk about that. So, and it goes back to the mission of Zoopy as well. How can gaming and technology can be a tool to create joy or eliminate suffering? That goes back to that. I'll give you an example that will show what gamification is and what is the power of gamification. Look at the games even our kids play or the kids today play. Hide and seek tech, chupa chupi and pagang pagta. Where do they come from? These were designed by our genius hunters and gatherers with the gamified the most important life skills, which was how to hunt and how not to be hunted. That is power of gamification. If you tell a kid, run 100 meters in the morning, he's not going to.
That's super insightful. I had never thought of it like this.
And then they've survived for 500,000 years. That is the power of gamification. How do you take something which is super essential to you and make it fun? And that is the one example. And gamification is not just doing leaderboards, streaks.
Which is what unfortunately has been reduced
yes,
to.
Yes, yes. It's about really deep understanding how do we create flow streets. And that can be done through anything and everything. Like I just gave the example, they gamified what was education at that time. That was education, right? So we do believe it has a huge role to play in across all aspects of learning. This is where we as Zoopy are very excited. So wellness as a theme, like I'll give an example. Everyone knows they should meditate. Everyone knows they should work out. Everyone knows they should eat healthy. But it's very hard to do. These are things very, very hard to do. And I think dieting is the one industry which has abysmal success rate and still like hundreds of billion dollar industry, something like that.
Yes.
So again, looking at fundamental human motivations, like all people have this need to be engaged. But it's a bit like giving people what they need versus what they want.
Yes.
What they want in a way, designing something which will actually serve them. That's where we believe the power of gamification is going to come in, and we are very, very excited about that. That is one like segue of gamification. And if you just talk about games, again, I think there's no doubt all the data says it's a very obvious fact it's future of entertainment. It's the only interactive source of entertainment, and others are just passively consuming, consuming content passively. So, and again, humans have this fundamental need to be engaged. We have an anti-boredom drive. The hardest thing for human is to sit still. That's why it's really hard to meditate.
That's why meditation is also a multi-hundred-billion-dollar industry.
Yeah, because we're not wired that way. Our ancestors who were more anxious and better planners survived more than happy-go-lucky who will eat and sleep.
Yeah.
So we are wired that way. So there's always going to be that need for engagement. And I think everyone would be paying attention. There's a big revolution that is happening with ChatGPT, the innovations in AI. And if you've been following that, you will see creativity is going to explode because everything is getting democratized. It's actually from text, you can create a movie.
Yeah.
The same thing is going to happen to gaming, right? It's all going to be that simple. Like Roblox did to an extent, but it's still very, very complicated. What we believe the future of gaming is going to be, even if you have creativity, you'll be able to design games as well. So that is where we are very, very excited.
Without the need for necessarily doing illustration and all the other stuff that will take.
So all of that is going to be just like feeding a text to create a movie. That's why you will be seeing all those Hollywood writers and all are doing sex and all.
Do you see like how soon or what are you already seeing in terms of how AI is changing things on the ground at gaming? Like at Zoopy, for example, what are you all doing already today?
So right now, I won't say we are leveraging it fully. I'll say we are still understanding. We are doing the basic use cases like without a doubt the developer productivity is 10x. Anyone is not doing that is just doing massive disservice.
Yeah.
So and like personally for me it has been great, like who has been a researcher or a philosopher all his life. So that's a great tool to have. But to really harness that, we are still coming up with the exact use cases, to be honest. So just coming back to the non-obvious USA yes. gaming merch. So yes. definitely massive democratization of gaming is going to happen. A guy sitting in, I don't know, tier 2, tier 3 town will be able to design brilliant concepts. And it's like bit like Tarun designing his own gaming universe, Dilshad designing his own gaming universe. And that's where the Web3 and blockchain is going to come in. And all of this is going to be interoperable. So it's going to be fascinating because the digital assets and NFTs all has been solved. And so that is some area to absolutely look out for how that's going to get shaped. The other is no-brainer again, play to one. So which?
So some of these things, there was a lot of hype last year, right?
Yeah.
Web3 gaming and play to earn and all that. And maybe it was all blown out of proportion and maybe we all sort of got too excited too quickly. Are you still a believer and do you still believe in stuff like metaverse and like do you still see like Web3 gaming, like do you still see it as something which is real?
Absolutely. I think it happens with everything. Like whenever a new tech comes, everyone gets maybe
too excited.
And you look at history, there have always been bubbles, whether it has been railways, industrial revolution,
yeah.
internet, crypto, whatever. And now 100% AI is going to happen. So, but the underlying concept is very, very solid. Like, just look at
if you unpack it, right?
Yeah, let's just take example of play to earn. So, it's no-brainer, right? If you are investing time, you can monetize your time. Why would you not play on that format versus just a freemium mode?
Yeah.
Like, you are not getting anything out of it. So, it's a no-brainer. But the nuance there is, I think people got overexcited. Just like, through NFT tech, you can't create Mona Lisa. NFT can enable it.
Mm.
But the underlying concept is still the underlying concept. The art and creativity still remains. You still would have to design great game concepts.
Mm.
NFT is like a tool that can only augment it, can bring other realities. But what happened in the hype was you were just, again, the real money gaming hype, which was just going on Play Store, taking popular games and integrating payment gateways. Just the integration bit doesn't
not solve anything for
right?
users.
It has to be fundamentally resounding concept that attracts users. But if you have that on top of this, this can be absolutely revolutionary. And we don't see any reason, like if, in a way, the way gaming evolved from, you know, web to mobile to freemium, there's no way that this, the next logical step is not clear to one. It just doesn't make sense. But again, it will take time. It will take refinement. Some people will burn their fingers. And ultimately, that is going to be the normal state.
I'll touch upon regulation. There's a lot happening. What's been, I guess, the biggest positive in the last, say, 6 to 12 months on what's happening in regulation with real money gaming? And where do you think more needs to be done to really unlock the potential? Like, we all talk about India becoming 10 trillion. If that has to be realized, you know, gaming will have a big role to play in that. We have several hundred million youth who are spending hours a day on this, right? It's a big tax pool, it's a big revenue pool, it's a big, you know, part of the time spent. Where are you happy with how things are evolving and where can more be done?
I think to start with, we all should be very excited with all that has been happening. Just to quickly rewind, 12 months out, 12 months earlier, what were the challenges,
yes.
what ambiguities that existed in the game?
Actually, now that you think of it, so much has happened
in the
last 12 months that didn't happen in the, like,
yeah.
you know, 10 years before that.
But like that, you know, weeks in which decades happened. So it has been a bit like that. So A, there was an ambiguity about overall, what is online gaming?
Yes.
What is game of skill? What is game of chance?
Is it like gambling or is it?
Yes. Is it a state subject or a center subject? What are the TDS laws? What is the right rate of GST? So there were so many ambiguities, right? So again, the center, and we are very, very grateful to that, the entire gaming community, the center government has seen how game is going to be an essential part of a $1 trillion digital economy tree. And they have come out super supportive of the ecosystem, building a very responsible ecosystem that is also the need of the hour. So METI has been appointed as a nodal ministry.
Yeah.
We were like orphans. We didn't have, as a gaming industry, no center ministry. METI has come out. And there's
actually, that's a big one. The fact that somebody has actually now made it there.
Yeah, we have been adopted.
Yes.
We are very happy. So, and then the rules have clearly come out. It's a like turning very innovation friendly. So like even the small time developers sitting out of small cities will also be able to create those games, and India can become like a net exporter for the games. And we have that. Like we have an amazing talent pool. We have amazing culture as well. We have amazing stories, cultural games that are there.
Yes.
So like that's what I used to say, you know, if you go on App Annie or any tool, if you look at the top games, only one would be Indian, which is Ludo King.
Correct.
And all of these would be Chinese, USA. It doesn't make sense. Like I said, there's so much talent, there's so much culture. We should be net exporters.
Yeah.
So I think the clarity that has come out on, you know, that it's going to be an SRB, self-regulatory body, governing the gaming, that has been amazing. Also, the TDS clarity has come out.
Yes.
This is, again, phenomenal for the ecosystem. Yep. So you being an investor, you know, I know, like we have had these discussions. Everyone says, hey, we get this a gigantic TAM. It's amazing unit economics. But what about regulatory? Now, I think you are going to see...
I think the floodgates of capital will just really...
100%.
And innovation as a result.
100%. So it's a very, very exciting time. And we have been very grateful for the government and the entire industry that has come together for building a very responsible and doing our part in supporting India.
What more can be done? Or do you think... everything that was like the big demands already being taken care of?
I think so. There are a lot of things that will still need to be done. So one obviously is the state advocacy. So there is still, like I said, a lot of awareness that needs to happen. You know, we see in media reports as well, online gaming and gambling are used interchangeably in a single paragraph. So that definitely is not okay. So there's a lot of awareness explaining, understanding what is game of skill, what is game of chance, and that yes, there is an objective way of determining what is game of skill and what is game of chance. So that will be very, very useful to the ecosystem. And the other thing I'll say is setting up these SRBs in a very structured, transparent and democratic way, but at the same time they do their job really, really well, so that we have very responsible gaming companies out there. The problem for the longest time was there wasn't one centralized body.
Yes.
That was laying down the guidelines, you know, what is responsible gaming? How the KYC should be done? What are the do's and don'ts? So because of that, what happens is one, two bad players, they ruin the entire ecosystem. So it's absolutely phenomenal that these SRBs are going to be there and going to have a standard charter, which every gaming company now has to adopt.
Awesome. No, it's honestly, it's been, it's, you know, when these things happen, they really, really positively surprise you. And the fact that technically we've had, you know, fantasy industry for a decade, we've had Rummy for probably close to 2 decades, and finally now it's actually getting clarity. It's been a big, big positive.
Yeah.
I'm going to pivot a little bit because I, you know, while we can talk about gaming and, you know, RMG industry for a long time, I think one thing I personally really, really enjoy is just talking about you as an individual. There's a lot that I wish I was even doing 10% of what you do today when I was your age. So tell me a little bit about, I guess, your own personal work ethic. Like, you don't talk too much about it, but I know I work with enough founders, I work with, you know, enough other people. I know what I myself was at, like, at your age. I just find your personal work ethic incredible. Just in terms of your discipline, your focus. So what is, like, for somebody who doesn't know you, like, what's your day like? What's your personal work ethic like? Somebody that you want to hire, what should he or she expect?
I think if we're to summarize in 2-3 words, it will just be always on. So, which is good also, and times could be not so good. So, I think never seen it as a work because I just love it too much. Just what I'm doing today, I'm just deeply, deeply passionate about deciphering human mind. I can do it my entire life, 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So, it's just a deep passion, fascination for what I do. So, honestly, I've never thought about this. It just comes so naturally.
Tap dancing to work. It's for you, it's not work.
Yeah, it's like, it's a very cliche line, right? Find something which is fun for you and work for others, you'll never lose. So, I think I was just lucky in that way. I tapped into something. And it's just that I never honestly thought about it. It's just something very natural to me.
No, so I'll tell you what I've observed. I think that the few things that for me really stand out is for you personally, and this is not blowing smoke up your ass, it's what I really believe. I think one is the always on, which I've seen, but I think the second is the curiosity to apply first principles to every problem statement, right? And I know, and we should talk about that, you have this sort of group of people that you rely on, and anytime you're faced with a problem, it's like part of your problem solving toolkit where, you know, you almost crowdsource solutions and crowdsource ideas, but it's not because you want somebody to tell you what to do. You're just basically crowdsourcing everything, applying, you know, pushing it through your own framework of sort of solutioning, and then coming up with something which honestly surprises us several times, which is, oh my God, how did he come up with this at such a young age, right? So, I think one that really, really stands out. I think the second is just the willingness to be very intellectually honest about where things are at. Like, rarely do I, there's a lot of good news that always comes from you and the company, but that's never been like, I know that when there is bad news, like, you will always call first. You will always share that first. And you're always mildly dissatisfied with where things are at, right? Which is a good, healthy kind of balance. You're not over celebratory when things are going well. You're not over upset when things aren't going well. I think that mildly dissatisfied is a great trait. I want to pick up on one more thing, actually. I should have covered it earlier when we were talking about gaming, and I'll come back to your personal journey as well. I remember you had gone to China once. And you told me about your biggest takeaway from that trip was you met a lot of gaming companies over there.
Yeah.
Most had either raised no capital or had raised very little capital, but were insanely profitable and sort of, you know, throwing out cash. And I think that was a turning point in your journey as an entrepreneur where you came back and said, you know, there is no need for me to build this the way some other companies are doing this, where they're raising and burning hundreds of millions. Like, gaming is something that one should be able to, you know, monetize from day one. What was the real takeaway beyond this? Like, what did you see? How is that one exposure and that one, I guess, experience shaped Zoopy into what it is today?
I think, yeah, that was a great experience. I think it's just that once you see something that can be done, or you see a proof of that, that is more than enough. And always had this thinking that everything is first principles. Everything is first principles. A doctor is a doctor, a lawyer is a lawyer, because it's all acquired knowledge. There's nothing metaphysical or some special blessing anyone has got. And there's just that DNA of truth seeking in everything, which is not always good. I'll tell you that. But it's just that understanding and having that exposure that, oh, it can be done. And people being very bullish about that and understanding the journey. And it's like every problem statement has a deep truth about it. So if you are able to arrive at that truth, you can create astronomical impact, and that problem is solved forever. So that to me was the most fundamental insight. Oh, it can be done. Now, can I reverse engineer it? What are those raw materials, processes, knowledge that goes into that? And if I have that, I can also do that. And just that exposure, you know, that it can be done and it has been done, really excited me.
And I guess it was contrary to what you were seeing in India, where,
yes,
like, you know, maybe you've thought that's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
Right? So
I think the other thing is maybe it has to do with the upbringing.
Yeah.
We come from lower middle class income household. You have to hack monetization. So I have always been hacking monetization all my life.
Give me an example from China.
So it's very embarrassing. Pen fighting tournaments. I used to organize, you know, at this entire setup. I used to be the organizer.
Pen fighting?
Yeah. And I used to sell pens also. Like, you make something like Transformers, but with pens. So I got quite famous and ultimately got into trouble as well. The principal called, seized all my pen. I was still net positive without the capex and all. So yeah. I think it's always been that. So always thinking about reverse engineering. So that comes very, very natural to me. So again, going back to the China example, is just that A, it's doable. B, going really deep. What are the conditions when they meet it happens? So can you also try to create those conditions? And the answer almost always goes into having a deep understanding, seeing the truth, that fundamental principle on which everything is built. So that is like the framework.
Yeah. No, it's been fascinating. I'm actually going to pick up on something else that I was thinking of. You know, very often as investors, you invest in a farm. I mean, we all invest very, very early, right? And what we've seen is there are times where companies growing at a particular Y-intercept and then the founder is growing at a different Y-intercept. And when they both are consistent, it's great. Sometimes the personal growth of the founder is even steeper than the company growth, and eventually then the company growth follows. And sometimes, you know, unfortunately, company growth outpaces the pace at which the founder is able to personally grow, right? I think for me personally, seeing Zupi so closely, your own growth as an entrepreneur, as a leader, has been fascinating to see. Because I remember the first time you used to hire people, and yeah, I know you're smiling because there's a long list of folks that you know we couldn't make successful. But today, you really think about your own responsibility as a leader, as a CEO, very differently from when you thought about it even 3 years ago, right? Just tell us a little bit about, and this isn't just accident, right? I'm sure you're doing a lot of work to build and make sure that, you know, you are growing as fast or faster than which the company is growing, right? And one follows the other, not the other way around, right? So what have you done? Talk a little bit about some of those things.
Yeah. I think I agree. So I think I myself have seen a shift. Initially, used to be more like a gunslinger. Yeah, assassin. Leave me alone. I'll conquer the village. But definitely, like, I'll give you a funny example. You know, people used to ask me, which is your favorite team? I never had a favorite team. I had a favorite player because of which I had a favorite team. So always, so this was the default nature. But as you, anyone knows, nothing great can be built without a very collaborative and supportive group. And at the same time, it's much more joyful and fulfilling. So it wasn't easy, that natural segue from your default personality. But I guess there's always been commitment that is there, doing what is required for the business, even if that means like shedding your personality like a snake, like moving or becoming something else. So never, I think the good thing is don't have any attachment to any identity or self-image. So just doing what is required to be done, easier said than done. It's difficult.
What is the hardest thing you had to change about yourself personally for you?
I think, honestly, this mindset of like the gunslinger to
so being a lone wolf and expecting that you can scale. Yeah.
And but like I said, it doesn't come easy. So what I've seen is that humans change their behavior either of two things. One, either is some amazing insight you get, or second is pain. And there's nothing better teacher than pain. So I think I'm grateful. I'm not going to claim I'm 100% there, and because all habits die hard. So still trying to understand that how I can be better. Just moving and this visceral understanding that how much joy there is in being of service and nurturing people. So that's a constant journey.
How do you see your role as a leader today different from a year ago?
Yeah, I think earlier, like I said, it was the mindset, you know, I'm Rambo. Leave me alone. I'm going to do everything. And that caused a lot of problems. Of course, like, then I realized, like, my role of being a coach. And again, even in coach, I used to think the role of coach is to have all the answers. But then I realized, oh, it's not. It's about being a space where people can feel they have the answers.
Yes.
Or can arrive themselves at the answers. Again, seems easier said than done when you have a lot of intellectual pride. And the impatience also, because you know what the right answer is. But it's until people arrive themselves at the derivation or the final insight, it doesn't viscerally resonate and doesn't create equal amount of impact. So still an ongoing journey, but this is something that I know is super crucial for both the kind of company we want to build and the overall health joy of the ecosystem. Because we have been always clear, we won't build a very mechanical organization. We will dedicate ourselves to overall well-being, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, at all aspects. So we have been making a lot of efforts on that, and our goal is very clear: to be the best workplace to that people across the world want to work with. It's a long journey, but we are very dedicated to that.
So if you don't mind, I'm going to share something which is I guess deeply personal for both of us. So we both have the same coach. We both absolutely love and adore her. She's been instrumental in both our own personal growth journeys in many ways. And people don't really talk about this often because, you know, nobody wants to say, I needed help. I needed somebody to help me break emotional barriers that were coming in the way of my success. Nobody wants to be shown the mirror. Nobody wants to feel like they're not good enough. But both you and I have experienced that. And I want to break the barrier towards maybe talking about that a little bit more openly. And I know it's, you know, you've been through a year of it and you're continuing on down that path, which is amazing. What have been the two or three biggest breakthroughs for you through that coaching journey?
There have been many. Okay, so if I have to pick the top two or three, I think it's in many ways, like, there's only one voice we hear as society. From society that is like almost, you know, bachchon ke bare mein bhi bola jata hai, jyada pyar doge to bigger
jayenge,
simple chad jayenge. Or it's just that always that default has been like love is weakness. Like,
dara ke rakho sabko.
And that's where the survival mindset also comes in, right? It was always been that if you love is almost equal to weakness, and you can't create a great company. If you want to create a great company, you almost have to rule with an iron fist. You have to be a certain way. That to me, and we went deep into that, the kind of research that we have seen, whereas Jim Collins were too great, there's a lot of empirical evidence.
Yes.
What really great, or in the book, they say Gear 5 leaders are. So that to me was really, really insightful. And to actually see the empirical evidence and scientific evidence for that, that to me was something very,
and so love versus fear, if I may just paraphrase, that was like using, I guess, love, gratitude, you know, making people realize their potential and helping them achieve that potential versus using fear as a motivator. That was one. What else?
I think the second one, if I had to pick, is just that understanding fear in much more detail. It's again very cliche lines. You hear all those cliche lines.
But understanding it viscerally and applying that.
It's the visceral understanding that moves things, right? So the other thing is just actions. You don't need courage to take actions. It's the actions that bring courage. So, and if you have, and the other really cool concept is, you know, identity goals versus purpose goals. The more your life is committed to identity goals, the more turmoil it's going to be, because you're building a self-image, which is going to pop at any second.
Yeah.
So doing things more out of service, and the Newton's third law, it's in giving that we receive.
Yes.
So all of these are very, very powerful concepts. But again, it's like we all have been hearing this one voice our entire life.
It's all English.
Yes.
And they don't understand.
First time you are hearing a different message, which resonates at a very fundamental level, but there's been so much conditioning, the way we have been brought up. So I think that is what it is really needed in organizations.
So you said something which I hope doesn't get lost. You said something very important, and I personally believe in it a lot, which is courage comes from taking action, not the other way around, right? We all, you need to commit to it, and then, you know, in doing that action is when you realize sort of greatness or whatever it is. Can you share an example of where you've actually done something where there was an action that you were postponing or you were fearing, and by doing that, you realized?
Yeah, I have a great example of that. So, as you rightly said, you know, you have a lot of intellectual pressure. Meko kya coach ki zarurat hai? So, as part of the program, there's a 360-degree feedback, right? Feed forward, she calls it.
Feed forward, yes.
Yeah. So, which is you talk to team, and which is you are basically, I remember, you know, I'm typing a message which I had to send to the group that, hey, I'm connecting you with so-and-so, we're giving feedback. That's almost like, you know, your cursor is at the
report card.
And you're like, hey, do I send it or do I not send it? But it's just the action of sending it, just openly accepting. It just moves things. They're like, the action has that power. When you do some things that really, really scare you, you do it and you see you can survive, then that shifts the personality. And like, I study a lot of psychology, so exposure therapy is precisely that. Whatever scares you, so like you have a fear of closed spaces, I move to you 10 feet, then 8 feet, then 5 feet, just stand inside the elevator, close the doors. Just once we do something that scares us and we see, oh wow, it was in only our head, that just opens the gates. That for me was that moment, is just clicking on that send button, and that just made me...
It broke those shackles basically that were preventing them.
And there will be lots of these actions.
Yeah. I know that. You spoke a lot about early days and sort of what you were doing in your you know, childhood and how that shaped you to get into gaming. When you think about your last, what, 26 years. What have been the one or two big experiences, either in childhood or otherwise, that have really shaped you into who you are today?
I think the couple of those that come to mind, one is the competitive nature. I think that comes from my elder brother, who is 8 years older than me. And I used to be in second class, he used to be in 10th class, but we used to compete on every sport. Cricket, chess, cards, football, hockey. We both are big into sports. Badminton. So obviously I was 8 years younger, I was gonna lose most of the games. And you know how kind elder brothers are, they don't only defeat you, they humiliate you also. So that I think really spawned the fire that now I reflected, I see that made me really, really competitive. And in my defense, once I reached 6th class, I haven't lost to him on anything, any sport. Yeah. So I think that is one experience I know just made me very, very competitive. The second thing is, I think I was just thinking the other day, how did this introspectiveness
come? Yeah.
And I remember, so there used to be Gurudwara just in front of our home. And they used to be, you know, like morning, they had 3 hours, or afternoon, they had 3 hours. And they used to be really deep lines that, you know, everything is one. The concepts of ultimate universal consciousness. So I think, and now I reflect back, I think it's these concepts that I was passively receiving without even actively paying attention. Something they just triggered. And I think that's where I see now where the very high introspectiveness comes in. I think that's the second one. And third, I've already told you the monetization aspect. That's where the monetization bug started.
What did you do to chase that? So when you realize that this study of human psychology fascinates you, I remember when, like, we were first talking to Invest in Zupi, you had told me, like, you reached out to PhD in psychology around the world, spoken to them, understood human behavior, literally which chemical is released in the brain with which action. And, you know, a lot of that has that, like, anything, like, how did you pursue that? Like, a lot of us have curiosity about different things, but sometimes we don't really take action into that and pursue it, right? But you have, and I know you speak to a lot of people that really, really get you to that first principles core insight of something. How did you, I guess, nurture that side of yours?
I think to start with, identifying people who get it, like Kunal has been a big influence.
This is Kunal of...
Great. So I think it's the way I think about this is just voracious appetite for collecting dots. Just keep collecting dots. And creativity to me is more about 90% is just collecting dots, 10% is connecting dots, right?
Mm.
If you have two dots, you can make a line. If a zillion dots, you can paint anything.
Correct.
I think it's just that, keep collecting without even knowing how it's going to connect. There's this insatiable appetite for that for whatsoever reason. I don't get it. So, and then seeing again the first principles, what are those pillars that come together? Like the example I gave, how we react in the moment is actually tied to what happened billion years ago and what happened 10,000 years ago. It actually comes down to what you ate in the morning. So it's a very, very complex field, looking at what are the fundamental pillars and just going super deep in that. There's been less of a structure. There's just been collection. And once you have so much collection, connections just...
They just form.
And I think it's, again, there's a deep love and passion for that. I can do it 24/7. So it only keeps compounding.
What's been the toughest moment of the Zupi journey? When you look back, what was the darkest phase? What made you go through it? A lot of young entrepreneurs obviously will listen to this. I really want something that you can share very openly, very vulnerably, and say, this was the toughest phase and this is how it helped me grow.
I think it would be just really seeing how you yourself can become a big bottleneck to the company. And the discomfort of seeing something because you can't unsee. And there's a lot of work that goes into shifting who you are as a human being, you're updating your beliefs or personality. So that to me would be the toughest phase, when I saw my default being is not actually serving the company. And then it doesn't happen like that. The patterns are very deep rooted from where they come from. So actually making that effort to move from a place where me, my personal beliefs or personality might be a bottleneck for the company, to a place from really evolving, changing who you are, that it actually serves the company. So I think that was a tough time. But it's an ongoing journey. I'm not going to claim I'm some enlightened human being. It's a ongoing journey. But
no, but thank you, man. I think it takes a lot of courage to be so open. I don't think 9 out of 10 people would like to acknowledge that they are coming in the way of their company's growth or success, right? And as a founder and as somebody who's honestly done so well, it's even harder to acknowledge that I guess the default is to actually get into a God complex that the company is so successful because of me. But to have the humility to say, but now the next jump is going to be, I may end up being that bottleneck. So thank you for being so vulnerable for it.
And I think that's fair. I would express my gratitude to you. You have been amazing. Harish has been really amazing.
Yes, I know he's been a very big supporter, cheerleader, friend, partner, thought leader, everything.
All those things, yeah. So I think very, very grateful to have you guys, who have always guided, supported, and that phase transition that happens, being really there for me and Zupi. So
yeah,
thank you so much.
No. I am fortunate and honored to be on this journey with you. So I know you have to run, so I'm going to maybe end with one last question. So what's next for Zupi? What's the, I wouldn't say ambition or desire or pressing, but what's the core, when nobody is around you and when you think about next 5 years for Zupi, what would make you happy?
I think the way I thought about this was, the mission is still there. How do you increase quality of life, eliminate suffering? These are very, very tough problems to solve.
Do you measure this, by the way? Do you measure, when you talk to your users? And I know you've told me this, that even people who lose on the platform, they spend more time and are more engaged than this thing. But how do you measure this? That are you improving somebody's quality of life with them being on Zupi for?
Yeah, that itself is, we believe, $1 billion or $100 billion opportunity. How to measure emotional wellness, spiritual wellness, mental wellness. So there are a lot of ways to actually do that. I think that goes back to what's next for Zoopy. So I think the idea is just some raw materials that the way we started. There's a deep passion for this mission. There's absolute love for the field. There's a gigantic vision. And then we realize, you know, the three pillars let's build, which would be get massive distribution, build a great brand, and get cash flow. So if you have these three things and other three things, the example that comes to mind is Tencent, right? So I don't know what the exact stake they have in Meituan, which is a food delivery company.
Yeah.
They have no business being a gaming company, getting into that. But our vision has always been, if you have great brand, great distribution, you have cash flow and build a reputation that you can deliver, can pretty much own the entire ecosystem.
Mm.
So that is the vision and belief we go in. And our mission of improving quality of life. Like I just said, gaming is just version one of our...
So you don't think of yourself as a gaming company at all?
No, not at all. It's like I say, it's version one. Version 100, we say, in a funny ways, can we design a product that leads humans to enlightenment? That is the kind of product we want to build. So version 2, version 3, version 4, version N. But again, we wanted to build fundamental pillars on which, like, Reliance is Reliance because Reliance Oil, Amazon is AWS. So you need to have distribution, brand, and cash flow. Then you pretty much can control your own destiny and, like I said, reputation. And then a deep vision and passion for a field. So that, to us, gaming is just version one. From here on, we want to be committed to our mission.
Awesome. No, it's inspiring. I think the fact that you have both the temperament and the tenacity and the long-term outlook to think that far ahead, and you have age on your side to do that.
So I'm slightly worried next week.
Yes, but no, it's inspiring, and it's thank you for giving us a ringside view to the journey and a seat on the table to, you know, see you as you sort of build this out. I couldn't be more excited. I think, like I said, when we started, I've learned so much just observing you and observing your growth. I think you're one of the few founders where I've seen a vertical line in just your growth as an entrepreneur since the time we invested. So thank you for keeping inspiring us and doing what you do. Really grateful, and thank you for doing this today.
Thank you, Trudy.
Awesome.